and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
So how long are we supposed to share here for?
20 minutes.
20 minutes?
Until
you stop.
See, when they tell me 20 minutes, I go for 45, just a warning. When I first came in here, actually, to Alcoholics Anonymous, I really had a lot of difficulty just talking, just speaking, because I was filled with a lot of shame, and I was very embarrassed about being here, about coming here, and I wasn't really in touch with it. But anyways, that's a long time ago, and I got sober in, I think the date of my last drink was April 27th, 1986, and I had arrived to Alcoholics Anonymous, I think it was February of that year, and I was kind of in and out. I went to my first meeting as a Montreal General and sort of dabbled with the program on and off for a month or two, and then finally I went into foster. But I basically came to Alcoholics Anonymous for two reasons. The first one was I wanted to stop drinking and I wanted to be happy. And it took me a long time to get here. Because I would never admit that I had a problem. I would never admit that I was powerless over alcohol, for all kinds of reasons, I suppose. But I guess I suppose part of the reason for not admitting that I was an alcoholic, when I was around 6 years old, I made a decision. I wasn't aware that I was making the decision then, but one of the things I wanted to do, I wanted to do two things in my life. One was I had decided that if I ever was going to get married, my wife was not going to be a maid, because I could see the way that the men and the women interacted back in, this was in the 50s, and the men, you know, were in the living room drinking and the women were in the kitchen doing whatever it is that they would do. And so I decided, A, my wife wasn't going to be a maid, and B, I wasn't going to be an alcoholic like all the other guys there. But anyways, a couple things happened. I started to drink when I was, I think, 12, 13. And for me, it was, I guess eventually it was a saving grace for me. Because most of my life, for all, you know, till I arrived to Alcoholics Anonymous, I really felt uncomfortable around people. I felt I didn't belong anywhere. I felt different all of my life. And for me, whenever I drank, all of those feelings went away. Life was exciting. There was no fear. I didn't feel different. I felt at par with everyone else. And life was great. So it took away all those anxieties that I had ever since I was a little kid. You know, up to... I guess when I started drinking more on a regular basis was when I was around 16. And I had... I lived downtown on Clark Street. And actually, I was thinking about, on my way over here, I was thinking about two things. I came along St. Antoine, and I remembered where Sandy and I lived. And that brought back some memories. And then I came along Sherbrooke, because I went too far. Came back, and I saw Clark Avenue, and I had a major resentment when I was, I guess, around 16. I was living downtown, and I was working at this community center with kids who were a bit younger than my age. They were kids that I had grown up with. And... the people that I was starting to hang out with, some of them lived out here in NDG, and they went to Montreal West High School. And I really didn't want to stay in school. I didn't really know why. Well, one of the reasons was I had a lot of difficulty with authority figures. And I really felt uncomfortable. I didn't know where I belonged. But when I worked with these people, I hung out with these people, we were all kind of all, you know, social activists, and we were involved in different stuff. And it was different than the people that I hung out with downtown, because it was a bit different. So I made this attempt to transfer to Montreal West High School. And I went there, and they refused to take me because I didn't live on Clark Avenue. And I mean, the principal told me this, that because I didn't live on Clark Avenue and I lived on Clark Street, he couldn't take me because he was worried about drug dealers and all kinds of stuff. And little did he know that a lot of the people that I hung out with came from the suburbs and they used to come downtown to smoke dope and drink. And it was kind of the in thing to be poor and to hang out with people who were poor. But I built a major, major resentment about that. And I, you know, obviously I was very hurt. And so when I drank, it was like, wow, it was great. So I started to, I guess, to drink more on a regular basis when I was 16. And I moved out of the house when I was 18, 17, 18. I guess I went back and forth a couple of times. Then I started to become almost a daily drinker when I was around 18. I was in and out of high school, and eventually I just dropped out. And I really felt uncomfortable, and I was in pain all the time. My father was an alcoholic. There was constant drinking. I could not sleep at night. I was always terrified we were going to make the front page of the Journal de Montréal, which is, you know, a very sensational paper, that, you know, somehow my father was going to kill my mother, and we were going to be on the front page. So I lived with and felt a lot of shame, and it was very difficult. And I used to actually juke school at Montreal High and go to the lectures at McGill that were really on families and how families would work and function. I had no idea why I was there. I guess it was a way for me to escape all the pain that I was experiencing. So, you know, for me, alcohol was like, was tremendous. But I did get into trouble a few times. And then eventually, I got married when I was really young. I think it was 21, 22. And the woman I married was, she was from Drummondville. And she came to Montreal. We got married. And she'd read somewhere, I think it was in the Chatelaine magazine, that the marriage that she wanted with me was one of these. She wanted to be a modern couple. And being a modern couple meant in those days that married people would take 1 week's vacation together and 1 week separate. And, you know, initially I didn't really like the idea, but then I thought, Jesus, while she's gone for a week, I can drink and nobody's going to bother me about my drinking. So it was great, you know. So we went to Prince Edward Island, and we went on a vacation there for a week. And on the way back, I dropped her off at her mother's, which lived in Drummondville. And I went home, and I drank for a week, and then she never came home. And I was devastated, and I had no warning. So it was very, very difficult for me. And then I continued to drink heavily, I guess that, for 1 or 2 weeks, and then I thought, man, I've got to stop drinking. And I could not recall the last time that I had stopped drinking, but I thought I better stop drinking because I just really feel like I'm going to get into a lot of trouble. And so I stopped drinking, I guess for about 2 weeks, and I went to my mother's family doctor who gave me antidepressants, and I took the antidepressants and got more depressed. And I just thought, like, this shit doesn't work, right? So I went to the bar, to the tavern, actually, and it's now a restaurant there on St. Lawrence and Sherbrooke. And I went in there and I proceeded to drink. And I was in a lot of pain and I didn't know what to do. And I went downtown and I took a brick and I threw it through a store window. And I waited for the cops to come and get me. Because of, I guess, you know, a lot of bad luck I've had over my life, they just never showed up. And I was, I was very hurt. I was getting a resentment. And I thought, well, what do I do now, right? Here, I'm finally reaching out to the world. I'm ready to talk. And they don't show up. So I walked down to the police station, which was on St. Dominic in Ontario. It might still be there, I don't know. And I went in there, you know, and I went to the reception area. And I said, are you looking for that guy who threw the brick through the window there? And he said, well, no, not really, but since you're here, have a seat. So I sat down, and then they called in a detective, and I told them my life story, and it was just pathetic. You know, I was just filled with tremendous, tremendous self-pity. I didn't know what to do. And then I said, okay, well, I got to go now. And he said, wait a minute, son. You're a danger to society, and you're not going anywhere. And I thought, Jesus, here I go. Here goes my bad luck again, right? First they don't come and get me, then I come in and admit that I've done something wrong and they won't let me go. So I built more resentments. But anyways, they kept me for the weekend. I got out on Monday morning, and I think probably only three or four times in my, you know, 18-odd years of drinking did I drink in the morning. That was the first time that I had I'd gone to jail. So I went and I went to the bar that morning around 11, I think, you know. And actually, that was probably the first time that I drank in the morning. And got drunk, and anyways. And so then the next year was just a lot of heavy drinking. Just, you know, a lot of self-pity, a lot of resentment, a lot of hurt. They're par for the course. And I guess 6 months later I started, 6 months, a year later, I started going out with another woman, but that was kind of short-lived, and did a lot of mescaline, and just like, I was just blitzed. And I continued to really, you know, just to drink for the next few years, work at odd jobs, and then eventually I was still part of I was still a political activist, and I had dropped out of high school. And a lot of my friends encouraged me to go back to school. They said, you know, that's your problem. You don't have enough self-esteem. You don't have enough confidence. Maybe you should go back to school. So I started to go back to university, and I applied as a mature student, and I got accepted at Concordia, and I started to go to school. And really, you know, there I always had the best of intentions. I would, you know, start classes at 10 in the morning, or I was registered to start classes. I'd go to classes for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I couldn't get out of bed. I was, you know, in bed at 3 in the morning. Couldn't get my assignments done on time. And so eventually what I would always do was just take evening classes. I'd switch them after a couple of weeks because you had, you know, there was a period of grace and you could just switch them over. And then I thought, well, my problem is time management. It's not drinking. And so I took a time management course. And that worked for about 4 days. And that was that, you know. And so I just continued to drink and stay in school and work at different jobs. And eventually, just, you know, my self-esteem just got worse and worse and worse. And eventually, I was thrown in jail again, but this time it was for a good cause. I was sober. You know, the next 10 odd years, I continued to drink, and just, you know, what can I tell you? It wasn't, slowly but surely, it wasn't working anymore. And I guess I remember around my 30th birthday, and I remember my 30th birthday for a couple of reasons. First, it was, I guess, a couple of days after, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And halfway through the conversation, the guy asked me for my phone number. I gave it to him, but I lied. I gave him the wrong number. So obviously they didn't come back. But also, during that period, too, I met a guy named Patch. Some of you may remember him. He, downtown, guy used to wear a patch. When he drank, he was a lot of trouble. And I don't say that, you know, I'm not judging him, but he would tell you the same thing. And so he was the least person I thought in the world who would try to 12-step me. But he did. But of course, when he did, it was about 3 in the morning, and I was really drunk, so nothing really got through. But around my 30th birthday too, I had also gone, when I was around 22, I had gone to see a psychiatrist, it was a psychiatrist at the Douglas, because I thought I was going crazy. It was shortly after my wife had left, and I drank for a long time, and I really thought I was going out of my mind. So I went up to the Douglas and, you know, kind of told the guy my life story, and he was a nice, you know, gentleman. I think he was from Pakistan, or might have been Pakistan, but anyways. So what he told me was, he said, well, you know, you're only around 22 now, and he says, you know, you'll only be a social drinker when you hit the age of 30. So come my 30th birthday, this is one of the reasons I always remembered my 30th birthday, I was kind of like waiting for like something to happen, right? Like something was going to drop from the sky and I was going to be able to drink normally, right? But of course it didn't work. And on my 30th birthday, I had been going out with a woman, I guess, for about 6 months, and we split up. But she called me, I guess it was in the afternoon of my birthday. She says, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm just sort of cleaning up the house. I'm getting ready. I'm going out. It's my 30th birthday. I'm going to celebrate a bit." And so she said, "Well, can I come over to see you?" And I thought, "Oh, great." So I thought, "Wonderful. Tonight I get laid, right? It's my 30th birthday. This will be wonderful." So she comes over and she brought a bottle of champagne which she had kept for, I guess it, she told me she had had it for at least 8 years. She said, "I was waiting for a special occasion and a special guy. And then for sure I knew I was going to get laid and I knew I was going to get drunk. And that was like a certainty." So we had supper and we went out and we went down to, I guess it was the Val de Nuit. And we danced for a few hours and she went home with a friend of mine that night. So I'll always remember my 30th birthday. Because I also didn't become a social drinker. I drank for the next 4 years. And the summer before I stopped drinking, which was 1985, and you all remember 1985 was a huge convention in Montreal. I think it was the 50th, if I remember, I'm not sure. And I was going out with a woman who was a Jewish Buddhist, and she used to ask me every once in a while how I felt about drinking, because she would always tell me, you know, drinking is like, it's poisonous for you, can't you tell? And I kind of like, it just wouldn't register. And at the same time that summer, when I'd go to her house, she lived on Hutchison near Milton. The convention was on and there was like alcoholics all over the place. And they were like from all over the world and they were like actually wearing name tags. And I thought, man, this is disgusting. Like how can these people walk around and parade and announce that they're alcoholics? And I would read in the paper and every day there was a story, I guess for about a week, I guess leading up to the convention, during the convention, a few days after. Every day there was a story about Alcoholics Anonymous, how there was no ice cream left in the city, there was no Perrier water left in all the bars, and of course there was always a story about some person who had slowly but surely recovered. And I would start to read it and I could never finish it. I could never, never finish the story because it was just too real, you know? And So I just wouldn't read it. And I continued to drink for a few months. And I was 40 pounds. I weighed 40 pounds less than I do now. Had a lot more hair. I was getting more and more depressed. I had tried to stop drinking many, many times. Many times I promised myself that I wouldn't get drunk anymore or I wouldn't drink as much. And I tried everything under the sun. I tried being, you know, a weekend drinker. I tried switching drinks. I did, you know, it's all the classic stuff. And so finally towards the end of, I've got to bring you up to Dave on my last drink here. I was still going out with this lady, and it was difficult actually because she we would get into these arguments. Sometimes it was about my drinking, but a lot of times it was just about, you know, the fact that I was very, very self-centered. And she used to tell me I was self-centered, but I was so self-centered I had no idea what she was talking about. It was almost pathological. It didn't register. And so we would get into a fight and I would go home. And I would drink, and then the next day she would call me up and she'd apologize. She said, "I'm sorry, it's my fault, blah, blah, blah." And like this went on for a few months. And of course, what I didn't realize at the time was that she would run to her spiritual leaders and they would say, "Well, you know, maybe you're part of the problem, you know? And maybe you need to look at yourself instead of looking at him all the time," which is what, you know, eventually I was taught here when I was ready. But so that always made it very confusing because it sort of made me, I think, you know, I already felt I was crazy, but this was making me feel even crazier. And so eventually I called Alcoholics Anonymous. We were still together. But we had broken up for, I don't know how many times we'd broken up. We had met at a, my buddy had died. And I went to this, I guess after the funeral they had a little get together. And so we were all drinking and, you know, nobody was falling down or anything, but we were all drinking and eating. And there was this woman there, and I sort of asked her on. I said, you know, who's the cute woman sitting in the corner there? So they told me her name. So I, you know, I went up to her and I said, I introduced myself. And I said, you know, how would you, I don't remember exactly what the words were. I would like to go to dinner for a drink or something. Can I get your phone number? And she said, well, why don't you give me your phone number and I'll call you. So I gave it to her and I thought, she'll never call. And I wrote it off. But the next day I did get a call, and it was from her, and she said, well, I called all the women in the neighborhood and they told me you were okay, so why don't you come over and we'll go for a walk. And I thought, okay, well, that's nice. And I looked outside and it was raining, and I thought, well, she's kind of bizarre, but I'll go over anyway. So I brought over a bottle of wine. And I guess the nice thing about her, she didn't really drink too much, so it meant that I could drink most of the wine, you know. And then within a week we broke up, but then a year later we were still together, so we should have, you know, it should have ended after a week. But anyway, so I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I call AA, and the guy asked me, said, well, would you like to go to a meeting the next day, because I think I had school that night or something. And I said, yeah, so I gave him my number, this time I gave him the right number, and I waited for them to call me the next day, and they didn't call. And I thought, holy shit, what kind of organization is this, you know? And I thought, it must be run by all those Americans that were here in the summer. And so when I get in there, I'm going to show them how to organize this, because this is really not very polite that they're not calling them, right? So anyway, so I called them back. And I said, you know, somebody was supposed to call me, and how come nobody's called? So the guy said, don't go anywhere. Somebody will call you very soon. So I guess within 10, 15 minutes, somebody did call, and I went to my first meeting the next night at the Montreal General. And that first meeting that I went to was kind of scary, because at the General, it was at the psych ward, and people were very nervous, very anxious, and you know, people were on medication, and people were coming to the meetings. You could hear the bottles jingle. And it was just, for me, it was a scary experience. Maybe for most people it would be okay, but I you know, it was kind of scary. And so I stayed sober that whole week, and I certainly went through withdrawals. You know, I had trouble sleeping. I could feel, you know, like at the beginning of the DTs, I just feel like things were crawling on me. I wasn't hallucinating or anything, but I'd been drinking like for, I don't know, 16, 18 years, almost every day. And to stop suddenly just like that, you're going to feel it. So after a week in AA, I broke up. I ended the relationship with this lady because that's what I really wanted to do. And then I went to another meeting the following week. And there I heard a gentleman speak who I thought was a bit bizarre. Because he talked about feeling different, okay? But before he talked about feeling different, he said that all of my life I had felt lonely. And I thought, holy shit, you know, the last 18 years I'd felt, actually not just the last 18 years, but most of my life since I was a kid, I'd felt alone in the world. I really felt totally, totally alone. I really felt that no one felt like I did. I really felt different. I really felt I didn't belong anywhere. And when this guy talked about those feelings, I thought, wow, this was like profound. For the first time in my life, I did not feel alone. And that was like amazing. It was truly, truly amazing. Now, he was from an upper middle class family. I was from a working class family. You know, he had grandiose ideas of being the Pope, you know, and that was like nowhere in my book. And he used to fantasize about being the Pope. And I thought, well, this guy's a bit strange, but I can certainly identify with him and I can relate on an emotional level. So I started to go to meetings with him. His name was Chris. Some of you probably know him. And he brought me to meetings for the next 3 weeks every night. He picked me up and we went to meetings. And eventually he became my sponsor. But the way he became my sponsor was I was I really didn't ask him because I was terrified that he was going to reject me. So I didn't come quite out and ask him. But after a couple of weeks, I said, I guess this kind of makes you my sponsor, right? And he said, sure, if that's what you want. So I got, you know, I got out of that one easy. That was pretty easy to handle. So he became my sponsor. And I guess what I was taught at that point was, well, you know, you go, there's a couple of things you have to do, he said to me. You have to call me every day for 90 days, and you have to go to a meeting every night for 90 days. And I thought, well, I don't, you know, call him every day for 90 days. I thought, this is a bit much, you know. I mean, this guy, after all, he's 10 years old. He's 10 years younger than I was at the time. I think I was 34 and he was 24, and I thought, this is a bit too much. But I thought, you know, no, I really want to change my life. I want things to be different. So I got to do what they tell me. And so without knowing it, I was ready to go to any length. And, you know, I proceeded to go to 90 meetings, 90 days. I called them every day. And after, you know, after about 2 weeks, it was like I was looking forward to calling him. You know, I kind of got into the routine of calling him. And so, and then I would go and visit him where he was working. And we'd sometimes have coffee in the morning or lunch. So it became easier to call people and to reach out for help. And then I started to meet a lot of people here, actually. And I used to come to this meeting on Tuesday night when we used to have little tables all over the place with little candles. And we used to smoke like crazy in these meetings. And I started to go to a meeting every night because I'd also told, if you want... there are winners or losers in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, well, that's a bit judgmental, I thought. You know, that's a bit rough to put it that way. But I thought, well, what the hell, what have I got to lose? So I started to hang out with the people who had gone to meetings, you know, not just them, but, you know, a lot of people I associated with were people who had gone to a meeting every day for a year or two. And I started to do that pretty much up to the time I started to work. I just, you know, for me, coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess Sean had described it probably many, many years ago, it was like going back to kindergarten. And for me, that's what it was like. I started to talk to people. I started to share people. I started to make new friends. I started to understand, I guess, you know, all the self-pity that I had suffered from all the years, you know. I was just filled with self-pity. And I just felt powerless, not only about not being able to stop drinking, but powerless about making the changes in my life. I really felt that I was just consumed with self-pity, that I couldn't change my life. That I was just, I had, you know, no power. But anyway, slowly but surely, I learned through here that it was very important to actually check my attitude every day, not pick up a drink, no matter how hard it got, no matter how good it got. Not to pick up a drink, because that was the bottom line, is that, you know, it was very, very important to understand the first step and to always remember that if I chose to drink, because it was always a decision that I could make, and actually it was one of the things that Sean had told me too, I guess, after, in my first year, when I said, well, I can't drink anymore, he'd say, no, no, John, you can drink, but what's going to happen if you drink? And I said, okay. And so I just continued to go to meetings and I continued not to drink. And slowly but surely I had a year of sobriety and I took my first year cake at Eddie's Follies. And I chose that meeting because it was a respectable meeting, because I was bringing my mother and father, but of course my father didn't come. But my mother came, so I wanted it to be a respectable place, right? So that's where I joined that group, and they had told me to join a group. So I joined a group, and I still had a sponsor. And I made a lot of wonderful friends, and I would call members of Alcoholics every day. Sean, I know I called Sean many times, and Sandy used to hear me whine all the time because we lived together. Which came a bit later, and actually Sandy was my best man at my second wedding. And So a lot of things happened to me when I was sober, and I could have drank. Actually, I remember one night I had come home and somebody had broken in, and the guy was in the house when I got there. And so slowly but surely, I escorted him out, and I was pretty nervous. But I got him out of the house, and that could have been, years ago, that would have been like, God, I need a drink, right? But I never even thought about it. And a couple of years later, I was assaulted with a steel bar down on Cavendish after having given group therapy to alcoholics and drug addicts. People wanted to stay sober that night. I got assaulted by three guys who'd gotten out of prison that day. And I was still living on... We were living on Agnes then. And that certainly could have been a reason to do it. But but life, life just kept getting better and better, and I kept getting more and more involved. And I'm going to finish with a quick story here. I guess when I was around 2 years sober, at that point I still wasn't in a relationship. I was part of the ICKIPAW, International Young People's Conference. And we were trying to bring the yearly Young People's Conference to Montreal, and I was on the committee. And we went to Boston to make a presentation. And there was thousands of us, and we really had a wonderful time. And actually, the staff really, really loved us too, because they said it was actually a pretty nice hotel. And they said, "You young people are so nice. You take the time to talk to us. You ask us how we are in the morning." Said all the other people come here, they'd never even look at us. So thank you very much for being nice to us. And and that's just, I guess, just Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the things that they teach us. So anyways, we made our presentation, I guess. And that night I was kind of tired, and I went to the room early, and actually one of the guys, what was his name? I think it was Francois. I forget his name. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He had asked me before getting there. He said, somebody's come at the last minute, and it's this young woman. There's no room in any other part of the hotel. Do you mind if she stays in our room? And I said, well, I'm a nice guy. I'm not going to say no, right? So I said, no, sure. She could stay in our room, because we had three beds, I think. So anyway, so that night I had not been... involved in a relationship. I was very, very horny, and I was because they had taught me to stay out of relationships for at least a year or two, and I did, and it was difficult in a way, and it wasn't difficult because I realized that really I was not ready. When I really examined myself and really went, I knew that emotionally I was not ready, because I finally understood that most of my life I had felt like an emotional cripple, and I really was not ready to be involved in a relationship. But sexually, I was ready. And so I go to this conference, and that night I go to bed, and I'm reading a big book, and I started to read the third step, because I had a lot of trouble with the third step and what it meant, and what is God's will, and how do you know when God is speaking to you? Does He actually speak to you? Does He call you? Does He send you a message? Does God work through people? I mean, I went through, all the scenarios, and it was, but before actually I got into bed, I went into the washroom, and this lady had left her lingerie all over the bathroom, and I had not seen lingerie probably in a year and a half, so it was very moving, but it was very difficult, And I really got kind of queasy, and I really didn't know what to do. And, and so I touched it. I touched the lingerie because it was nice and soft. It was imported fabric. I knew it wasn't cheap. And then I went to bed, and I started to read the third step. And I thought, okay, what does it mean? Blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden, she comes into the room. She says hi, and I say hi, and I'm reading in bed. And then... she goes in the bathroom, and then once she comes out of the bathroom, all of a sudden I could smell this wonderful perfume, right? And my mind says, John, this is God's will, man. She's ready now. Because she came in there, she came in before, she had no perfume on, so she put the perfume on. There's a sign here from God, John. So you gotta go for it. So anyways, I left the convention, and I went home the next day. And I got off the bus downtown and I lost my suitcase. I couldn't find my suitcase. I had the keys in my suitcase, and I was like, at this point, I was going out of my mind. And I got on the subway, and I took the subway actually out to Pudong, and I got off the metro. And before at that point, I was living on, I think it might have been Pudong. I forget. Anyways, doesn't matter. So before I'm coming, walking along the Maison up, and before I go up the street, now I'm really getting resentful. Okay, now I'm resentful at God because, you know, I've been working the steps, I've had a sponsor, gone to all these meetings, and I could see everybody was in a relationship and people were having sex all over the place, and I wasn't. I was really getting resentful, and I really thought it wasn't fair. And I look up towards the sky as I'm going around the corner, and I said, you know, when am I going to meet somebody? It's not fair. And all of a sudden, from my right, I hear, "Hiya, handsome." And I look over, and there's this woman, and she's about 75, and she's pissed drunk. And I thought, oh, God, this is another, this is God's will for me, right? And then I continued to walk, and I just said hi. And then sort of guilt took over, and I thought, well, you know, maybe the AA ways, I'm supposed to go back and help her and do something. And then I realized, no, it was, you know, my higher power telling me to lighten up. And I went home that night, and somebody called, and they said they found my bag and my keys. And I went home, and actually it was the first night that I'd slept, that I'd really slept well in 2 years, because I really realized that I needed to lighten up, because all of my life I'd been very, very intense. I lived in an alcoholic home, and I was the eldest of seven, and I just, like, I needed to be in charge all the time and try to control everything, fix everybody. And laughter was really not part of my makeup, you know. And now I'm involved in theater, you know, and I do lots of stuff. And at work, I'm considered the resident crackpot. That I'm sometimes not serious enough. So my life has changed radically, and life is a hell of a lot better. And thank you very much for listening.